Is this close enough? My favorite thing about KUAC-FM is that it's on the air. I don't know what we did before we had KUAC. We did have a radio, but I really came alive with radio in 1962 when when KUAC-FM went on the air and I got my first FM radio. And I've been a fan for all the 30 years that you've been broadcasting. So I am one of your older admirers. I can remember the first few years when you were on the air and most of the radio broadcasters were students. And it used to be a comedy of errors to listen to them because a lot of them didn't have the foggiest notion how you pronounced an Alaskan name. And they sort of stumbled over all the composers and all of the ways of announcing classical music and that sort of thing. It wasn't their bag, you could tell. It has graduated and improved steadily over the years. It's really a pleasure to listen to KUAC because you've even your volunteers now are very well trained. They have obviously had a lot of briefing on a lot of things when they go on the air. And I certainly don't know what we would do without particularly the news coverage that you get over the FM radio. It's excellent. All the way from the morning edition at 6 o'clock to the end of All Things Considered in the evening. And I certainly like the Christian Science Monitor, which has come on more recently. And I really appreciate what Ann Thornton and Nellie Moore are doing with the half hour of local news at noon. I think they're doing a superb job with that. So I'm a news junkie, so that's okay. But I also like classical music, and I thoroughly enjoy Sandra Chapin's program in the afternoon. She comes across beautifully, and her selections are always excellent. And, you know, it's one of the nice things about KUAC is that you become acquainted with the voices of the people on it. And it's just like public broadcasting in general is that I think we identify with the voices of the people that we hear regularly and come to know how they think and how they view situations. And you have a real feeling of warmth and empathy and trust. That's one of the things that I think you do have with public broadcasting is a real trust in the integrity of the news broadcasters and the commentators that you listen to. And it really gives a much better sense of security. There are so many people who are going around doing a lot of BSing. That's one thing I think that public broadcasting, National Public Radio and all the public radio stations don't do. Well, I think the variety of programming that you do is superb. I like the span of it. I was a tremendous Garrison Keillor fan over the many, many years that he was on with Lake Wobegon and that sort of thing. And there are just features like that which have really added a lot to my existence because, radio does supply a need out up here. We don't have all of the variety of offerings that you can get in a big city. And in a way, it's good because you don't have to keep tuning around to try to find something that you want to listen to. You just leave it on the dial and there you are. So I like Radio Reader most of the time, too. I've heard some really excellent stuff that he's done. So I think the scope of KUAC-FM is excellent, and I want to congratulate them on their 30th birthday.
Thank you.
Okay.
It does. You do many things that I'm not aware of because I can't listen all day long. And I
guess our problem, at least at this point, is money. It all comes down to the state's been taking money.
No, it isn't money. I want to dispute this. It isn't money ever. It's the idea that individuals have, and the dedication to pushing those things. The money comes after the fact. You don't start with money and do this. You do it, and you get the money. Money comes after the fact, not before the fact.
Good point. I guess.
And you can get any sum of money, I think, that you want if you're doing those things that compel the attention and the participation and the sponsorship and the support and whatnot. Now, that sounds like it's backwards, but it really isn't. Do the great job. I used to tell your legislature, I used to tell the faculty, the very best promotion and advertising that a university has is that exceptionally fine performance in the classroom and the laboratory every day. That is the best promotional piece you can possibly get. All right, now, that used to be when instruction was confined to the laboratory and the classroom. It's no longer confined to the laboratory and classroom. It goes out over this and over the airways, the television and the radio. You are a part of the instruction of this place. You're the substantial part of it. And you can reflect what the university is and what it does and what it means to people. And I think you're doing a great job of that in some ways. But it still is something less than the heart and soul of the university that it could become. It could become. And I hope for the time when you can, but I don't think you're going to get any large sums of money to do this. I don't think you can draw up a plan and say, give us this money, we'll do this. I think you got to start doing it, and then you'll get the money. And you are doing some of it.
Some people are sensitive to the fact that they don't want us to be perceived as a university mouthpiece.
You've got to be. There's no reason for your existence on the campus unless you are. Now, I know what you're talking about. And there is a fine line of distinction that must be drawn here. But if you aren't a part of the university, why are you here? Why aren't you down in the Northward Building or something? Why are you associated with the university if you are not its voice? Just the same as a teacher in philosophy or a teacher in physics or a teacher in anthropology. You are a voice of the part of the university. You got to be. I know they're kind of a fetish in the attitude of some people, that we mustn't be perceived as a spokesman for the university. We're not going to do anything to tell about their arts program, their athletic program, their instructional program, their scientific program. We exist for ourselves. And why should anybody support you in the budget? For individuals to give you money to do your thing, that's free enterprise, that's okay. But for it to be a part of the budget of the university.
I think we've swung back. I think when I...
So there's a balance point.
Yeah, yeah. When I got here, that was a real strong feeling. But since I've been here, and it wasn't me, but it was other people who noticed that was a problem, I think we have started to swing back.
Oh, the faculty is very upset about it at one time, I know. That's after my day, because when we started, it was the radio had two goals. One, it was a laboratory for a student training who wanted to go into broadcasting field, either as an engineer, and the students came over from engineering and did all the maintenance and operated the equipment. And the programming then was for the people in arts and letters that were interested in becoming radio broadcasters, radio journalists, or whatnot. So we used it as a, and in fact, the only way I ever got it approved by the Regents was the emphasis upon this. This is a laboratory of our academic instructional program. This is a working laboratory. And I couldn't have gotten it approved initially without that. Now, you probably still do this. I suppose you have a lot of students that come in and you train them how to be disc jockeys or whatever it is, and maybe even pay them. No, we didn't pay them originally. It was a part of their instruction. Mm-hmm. They got this as a laboratory credit. But that's only one aspect of it. You were also, then in addition to that, then you were the information arm of the university. You reached out from the university to tell the people that this is your university and here's what's happening up there.
And that role hasn't changed.
I suppose not. Oh. Well, it's an interesting enterprise, and you've succeeded magnificently with it, and you won all sorts of honors and whatnot. But there's still the feeling, I think, in the faculty and in the community, that this is a great radio station. It's more on the television than the radio. Radio pretty well accepted. It's a great radio station. But what does it have to do with the university? And you got a selling job on your hands. You have to sell the university. Now, one of the things, if it doesn't happen, is that there comes a time in budget cutting when they look at numbers and how many students are you teaching, how many research projects for the university are you doing, and what. Well, then you had to come down and say, well, none, but we have this outreach program of information. Well, does it inform the people about the university and state affairs? Or doesn't it? Well, it's ideas. It stretches the mind. It's creative and stimulative and so forth. And when they're crunching numbers, it's often difficult to defend that position alone, although it's very important. It's very, very important, but it's hard to defend in a budget crunch. If somebody's got 200 students over here, and you got two, and they get down to numbers. But if you're doing something that keeps a person with 200 happy, that you're making it easier for him to build a case or her to build a case for financial support because of the tremendous job that they're doing in anthropology or whatever the hell it is.
Tell us about...
You have to brag a little. Yeah. You have to brag a little about the university and about the state and about its people and about its great resource base or whatever it is. The joy of living in such an environment as we have. You have to brag about those things. what am I sitting here doing this for? We're right trying to raise money for you, what you do. Tell me the good things you're doing now that you think you're having the most success with. I like the classical music, but that's my taste. Whenever you play rock and roll, I just turn it off.
What about the national news programs?
You do a very good job on that. Initially, you were 6 hours ahead, this station, the radio station, 6 hours ahead of AP, because we got it in over the air, and we got into trouble about that. And this goes back into the history that the outlets, the AP outlets, were complaining at the university, were getting news from coming in over the pole, or having 6 hours lead time on them. Please cease and desist, destroying our access. And there are some other instances of that, but the university was so far ahead, so they had to tone it down and to keep from being blasted out of the...
How many other stations were on the air in 62?
Well, I came in 60. You came on, I think we set this up, the students had a little operation and we bought them out. Well, it was just on campus. It only had five, what is it, watts power or whatever it is, whatever the unit is of power. They only had 5 megawatts, right? And it's, you could get it by hooking into the radiators or if you had the right fillings in your teeth or something of that sort. But it didn't go out very far. And we bought it from the students for $1,000. The Board of Regents bought it for $1,000. And we got grants, and we bought secondhand equipment from the University of Washington that was upgrading theirs. We got the whole thing as for $20,000 or something like that. And we got the license through Charlie Northrop, helped us get the license, and Bob Olson here in town. And some others, Sylvia Cernix. We helped to get the permit to, and I think we went to what are you, 50,000 watt now, or 10,000?
10,000.
You're 10,000. And then it became a pretty big instrument, line of sight at least for 100 miles in any direction. And that was the beginning, that was the early beginning. And the students finally came back, and they have their own now again. And I guess they have a fairly good audience on that, but the big audience is KUAC. Mm-hmm. A lot of us simply turn it on in the morning and leave it on. We like the classical music. And
why did they decide to go on FM back in 1962? That was almost an unknown mode back then.
Well, we had to avoid competing with the AM stations, mm-hmm. or we would have gotten no support from the regents, or see, that's interfering with private enterprise. So we were there were no other, as I remember in those days, there were no other FM stations at the time. KGNP came on, I think, FM later. I think they were originally AM only. They came on FM too. And then there's half a dozen others now. But it was to avoid competing with the local, with the Augie Hebers and the, who had the other station? He just died. He was crippled. Oh, well.
Bramstedt.
Bramstedt, yeah. Bramstedt and Augie. Those were the only two stations here when I came, and the university. And then KJNP came in, and then it got to be real powerful, 50,000 watt and whatnot. All right, well, that's the answer as far as I can remember. It was because the company, we went FM. And then there was, at that time, an opinion of whether it was a scientific fact or not, that the FM had a higher quality for the reception. It's a higher tonal quality. Now, I don't know whether there's a word of truth in that or not. You'd know, I wouldn't know. But that was a feeling, that was it.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, FM, we thought, had greater
It's
potential.
A known fact now. Back then, it may have just been a feeling. But
yeah. It is a known fact that it's more sensitive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell you, you have at this university, over the years, you've had some very wonderful people in the sciences that were way ahead of their time. And this has been almost traditional here. That's how we got the Geophysical Institute. And it's way ahead of its time on some of these space things now. But we had that in electrical engineering, too. And they did some fantastic... One Christmas vacation period must have been 30 below. They got materially students of the electrical engineering department, and their professor, Bob Morris, Bob, I think that he's retired now, Merrill, Robert Merrill, Bob Merrill. They got the equipment from the Dew line or the White Alice line or whatnot, and they took enough parts from it to put up the equipment on the top of the engineering building. This must have been in the mid-60s. That they could pick up things that nobody else in the state could pick up. And that's how we got in trouble with the newscast. That's how that started. We got in trouble because we had it 6 hours ahead of what the people on the AP and UP in those days were getting. 6 hours of lead time. And the students did this, and the faculty. There wasn't a penny of budgeted money in it for equipment or the time or anything. It was just, I talked about if you'd gone through the normal process of you lay out the plans and you seek the money to do something like this, it would never have happened. Mm-hmm. But it did happen. And it made possible your successes in later years in television and radio here. It made possible. Well, ask me some more questions. I'm taking up your time. And what we want to do is to get out so we can raise some money for your operation. You need it.
How about wishing us a happy anniversary? It's 30 years this year. Since
30 years. I'm just delighted. And I hope that you have 300 more at least, real good ones. You cannot have a great university, our center of learning, unless you have a great library. You've got to have accumulation of the wisdom of the ages. And today you cannot have a great university unless you have a great radio and television department. Not only to provide instruction and train people in the discipline, but again to inform the general public that may not have any other contact whatsoever with the university. Except by the airwaves. That's their only connection. And you have to have it if you're going to have a great center of learning. And this is right here, a very great center of learning already, and it's going to be greater. So they can't get along without you. And you could exist separately. But your importance in the world would diminish dramatically and very quickly. Yeah, so you need one another because you're a part of the same. Mm-hmm. You're a part of the same. I don't know
we'll
if that's going to
that
help
in mind
you.
Over the next 30 years.
How's that going to help you?
That'll help. That'll help a great deal.
What can we do to help you raise the money, though? Is there any other questions you want me to have a go at? I've talked here, and I don't mean to be critical at all. I'm trying to be analytical. political. Mm-hmm. This is a very real matter, and I think it needs to be addressed quietly and calmly, and everybody sit down and say, well, how can I help you? You know, because we've got to, you've got to build up the entity, the whole, in order for the parts to thrive. You have to build up the entity. There's this, what is the word that I wanted? That's that where the whole is greater than the sum of its individual parts. There's a word for that. It's not serendipity, but it's about something of that sort. And that's what we're talking about here, that the whole is greater than the sum of its individual parts. And what you've got here is a great center of learning in the northern world that has no duplicate. It has no duplicate. And for you to be the great voice of the North, that whole entity has to prosper. It can't really prosper without you being it's the voice of its heart and soul. Now, how do you do that? I don't know how you do that. that's just talk, just theory. I don't know how you do it, but that's what you're about. You are the interpreter of a great center of learning to the people of the world, not just of the state, but of the world. You're its interpreter. And if you're just talking about what happens in Florida or what happens in Timbuktu or someplace, that's fine to bring in as adjunct of information. Mm-hmm. But what is happening here and why is the real story. That's the story. What's happening here? Why? What is there to do that isn't being done yet? It's the unsolved problems that are the excitement, not the solution is never an excitement to the extent that the problem is. Mm-hmm. That's the challenge. That's what moves the world. The things that aren't known, not the things that are known. And that's a silly sort of a statement, isn't it?
Makes sense.
Lincoln Steffens was a great writer at the early part of the century. They called him the Muckraker. And he, in his autobiography, he tells of the time that he was asked to teach at Harvard. And after this career in journalism, and which he had made a tremendous reputation, that he exposed the sleaziness of politics in Cleveland or wherever it was, and the people with the fine names and reputations that were crooks at the time. He had exposed a lot of that to bring it back to where the people were getting a much better look at what was happening than they were when it was all controlled by a few. Mm-hmm. Never going to, all right. Well, one of the things I remember from his autobiography, and it's an excellent book to read, Lincoln Steffens autobiography, was that in Harvard he taught that year basically the things that were not known, rather than the traditional approach. You start with the history of the discipline, and you add from the known, you add the new developments and whatnot. He started out here. This is what we don't know. How do you cure the common cold? And he worked backwards then, using, and he got people to go and look and find out what do we know on this topic. And really what he was following there was a kind of a scientific process. You postulate the perfect solution to a problem that exists. Lord Kelvin did that in his experiments in England. You postulate the perfect thing that you want. Then you go back and find out what's known that makes it that leads in this direction. And then all you have to do is bring these two together. So the whole process of research, scientific process, is trying to bring the known up to the edge of the unknown. So you teach people what we don't know to stimulate them to learn. Interesting idea.
Yeah.
Interesting idea. Well, how do you feel about the campaign? Do you think it's going to...
The upcoming campaign?
Yeah.
We've decided on a goal, $100,000 higher than last year, so we've got our work cut out for us.